Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Jessica Knoll, and we are going to be talking about her novel, Bright Young Women. It was an instant New York Times bestseller. Yay, yay, yay. And before it came out, it received starred reviews from all the industry publications, Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, and Booklist. And it's a Book Reporter Bets On selection. Those who know, follow me, they know how much I love this book. Bronwyn Miller, our reviewer, had this to say about it. Bright Young Women reads like a thriller, but it is so much more than that. It's about the misogyny of violence, sensationalism, sisterhood, the lessons we learn, and listening to our instincts. Above all, though, it's about survival and how we deal with the hand that we are dealt. So with that, welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
There's your buildup there. So What was your inspiration for writing the story from the point of view of the victims of a very famous serial killer?
Yeah. It started with, there was a new documentary out about him in 2019, and it was like pretty like buzzy, like a lot of, you know, people were watching it and talking about it on Twitter. And I think the part of the documentary that really stuck with me was the judge's comments, the judge's remarks when he sentenced the serial killer to die for the crimes he committed at a sorority house on Florida State University campus. And he said to him, "You're a bright young man. I would have loved to have you practice in a courtroom before me, but you went another way, partner." And he called him that, partner. He called him comrade, my friend, all these kind of terms of endearment throughout the course of the trial. I discovered once I requested the transcripts and got my hands on them. And I was really disturbed when I heard, you know, when that was kind of unearthed. And I started just getting more interested in the case and kind of researching maybe what I thought I knew about the case, but what I didn't actually know, because I didn't actually know that he was ultimately captured for the last time. He was captured many times.
Yes.
In Florida. I'd always associated him with the Northwest, with Seattle in particular. And so I think I just did that thing that we kind of all do when we watch something that has you know, a true element to it, where you just start kind of like Wikipediaing things and like going down rabbit holes. And I just got really sucked into it. And the biggest thing I kind of came away with was like, we didn't know a whole lot about the women. And I started thinking like, what would it have been like to have lived through this? And to kind of, I love that term, the misogyny of violence, but the misogyny of the press at the time was so horrendous. And I think as like a survivor myself, I felt drawn to this story and to correcting the narrative, because I realized we got so much of this case wrong.
Yeah. I also remember that we were out in Colorado one time and they had talked about he escaped from jail in Aspen. And my husband and I met in Crested Butte and spent a lot of time there. And where was he heading when he went in the wrong direction after he escaped? He was on his way over the mountain to there and he got lost and went in a circle and ended up back in Aspen. But we were there and you realize how not only escaped there once, he escaped twice out of the same area. And where he was headed, and I think of what that town was like and what it would have been like if he got into that town. And it was just these little things you think about him through the years because of all the places he was and the things he did.
Yeah. The escaping from prison became a big part of the story that I wanted people to really, I think vaguely I knew that, but once I understood the circumstances of it and the fact that it could have been prevented so easily twice. Mm-hmm. And that if law enforcement had just done their jobs, that three people would still be alive and they would still be quite young. Like the two women who were killed at the sorority house would be in their 60s. And then the Lake City victim, who was only 12 years old, she was his last victim, she would only be in her 50s. And I think I thought of this I thought of this crime and this period as being like part of a bygone era. But when I did the era, when I did the math, I was like, this is still contemporary. Like, there are implications of this crime that families and people are living with to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their siblings, they're people that they remember this happening to their sibling. I grew up in New Jersey, and I actually grew up in Cedar Grove. So I really love that the book opens with Pamela in Montclair, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And it's day, I love this, 15,695. Mm-hmm. And this is since that incident, this is have been how long it's been. And it's like, it's on your mind. It's constantly on your mind. Yeah. And from there, we go to a chapter called 7 Hours Before, and we count down back and from there. And right away, you had me like that. Was that always a kind of, I feel like it's like a cold open that you did of here's where we are, here's where we're going. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, initially it just started in the past. I didn't have the kind of cold opener, as you call it, with her in the present. That was actually something that took a couple of attempts to kind of get what the kind of through line would be with the present. Because I think initially I was like, why is she looking, what is the impetus for her to look back at this, you know, time? Like, what's the kind of engine? And I think I tried something like she was sitting down to be a part of a documentary, and my editor was like, well, we've already done the documentary thing in your first two books, so like we might want to chat. And I was like, oh damn, I really have like kind of beaten that to death, no pun intended. So you know, it was this idea that for a lot of the victims that and the families that they didn't get answers. They remains were not found. They weren't able, you know, to hold funerals. Like they still have questions that are unanswered decades later. So it was, you know, this idea that maybe they could get answers for one of the victims all these years later that kind of caused Pamela to reflect and look back on that time in her life.
Yeah. It was, you know, our first point of view is from Pamela Schumacher, who's one of the fictitious characters, the survivors of the defendant's infamous sorority house attack, which left, just to get people up to speed, of 2 dead and 2 horribly injured in 1978. Now, Pamela is somebody who sees somebody leave the house, and she thought it was somebody known to the girls. And from there on, things go a little bit off kilter. And then we follow the days after the attacks, and you get readers thinking, what'd you really see? Like, what did you really happen in that moment? And I remember when I was in school, people used to come and go, and it was so-and-so's boyfriend was in the house. Oh, they left the house. They could have had the biggest fight. I mean, he could have killed the person in the other room. You wouldn't know. It's like, they just come and go. Was that really like what you had us thinking about? Well, what did you see? What's going on?
Yeah. What's interesting is with the case that became quite notable about a year ago, the Idaho murders at the college campus, there's a symmetry between what happened with the eyewitness there and what happened with the eyewitness at the sorority house in 1978, which was something that's called environmental evidence. It's like this protective mechanism that our brains kind of pull out in moments of stress and danger, which is you start thinking about your environment. You know, this is a college house, you know, in the case of the Idaho killings, it wasn't a sorority house, but it was a party house, you know, college house, young people living in it. They just had a big party the week before. There were, you know, pictures all over social media of that party. The person who lived in that house thought, maybe my friend and her boyfriend got into a fight. And she's crying, you know, that's why she's crying. She opened the door, saw a strange guy, and was like, someone brought someone home. Your brain very, very quickly kicks into gear to make sense of something that is senseless that you're seeing and something that's just far too frightening to process. And is like, this is what I'm used to seeing in this environment. And so this is what that is. Close the door, go back to sleep. And so there were a lot of people questioning that eyewitness saying, she must have been involved. You know, who just closes the door and goes back to sleep? But if you understand, it's very complicated. And I was reading about that and thinking, oh my gosh, that's exactly what happened in the eyewitness case at the sorority house at Florida State University.
Yeah. It's like, Wait, I'm not sure what I saw. Yeah. You know, I remember I was a college at the time and I was at Fordham in the Bronx, and like the Bronx at that point was like nervous enough to leave the, you know, the campus. Yeah. But then you sit there and realize how crazy this was, because we were all in our dorms thinking, this is somebody our age that this happened to. And you think about before the rules got strict, you can't get into a building anymore. People came and went and they were in and out. And I think that was a huge wake up call to us sitting in our dorm of this could happen. This could happen like that, because you just don't know who's coming in and out. So I don't know.
Must have been terrifying. Yeah.
It was because it was somebody around our age. This is somebody who, and it was a whole group of women living in a building. There were all these people that were living in a building, and how vulnerable were you? And, you know, we're in this high rise on 195th Street and you're thinking, oh, like, could somebody just walk in? You know, what's happening? So now, were you in a sorority
when you were in school? I went to a small liberal arts college in upstate New York called Hobart William Smith. Mm-hmm. And they actually don't, and it's actually, two separate colleges. So William Smith is the women's college and Hobart is the men's college, but we have all our classes together. There's still some dorms that are like the all girls dorms, but there's also co-ed dorms. And the women's college has never had sororities. So there were fraternities on campus because Hobart allowed fraternities, but we did not have sororities. So that was another. Not only did I have to kind of do a lot of research to get myself in the time period that I was writing in, I had to do a lot of research to understand kind of the Greek system and what it was like to kind of rush a sorority and live in a house full of 35, 40 women, paying your dues, what the rules were, what the conflicts were, what was so cool, you know, what was so great about it. So all of that was a big part of the research process for me.
And it's also what the sorority was like then compared to what it is now. So you actually have to research, what is it like in 1978, where things have changed so much. You know, one of the women killed was this woman, Denise, and she was pretty and popular, and it's common to blame the victim. But the sorority's chapter council didn't want, I love this, a couple of salacious headlines to overshadow a storied 75-year history, as though our governing body cared more about our reputation than they did the safety of wanting us to return to normal as quickly as possible. So they turned the locks, and they had the girls move in. And the rooms where somebody had either been killed or hurt, we'll paint the walls and we'll move some furniture in and see who wants to go live in those rooms. And so the woman who's in charge of the sorority is now thinking about, she's actually in charge of all these women, making them feel comfortable. And it put a lot of burden on a really young person of just go back and keep things the way they were. It was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and of course it is fiction, and the character of Pamela is invented, but I do know from my research that they moved back into the house about a week after. It wasn't that long until they were back in the house, and there really wasn't a whole lot that they did for them between the university and law enforcement. There wasn't a lot of support that they offered them, like where they could stay and armed guards all the time. They were really just like, put locks on your door and make sure you're not, you know, walking anywhere alone. And they had members of their sweetheart fraternity who would kind of stay up as guards all night, but they're not cops, you know, like they're not trained. So I don't know. It just blew me away. What actually really blew me away was the similarities for me as a survivor of violence myself, and this story where, like, as a victim, you're kind of just on your own, you know, like you don't really get a lot of support. They're kind of like, oh, just figure. I mean, there isn't the budget for it. There isn't the training for it. There isn't the understanding for it. And I was like, wow, I can write about this because I understand what that's like. And I think a big challenge, when I say I can write about this, one of the biggest challenges of writing a book is, how do I tell a story? How do I find my characters, you know? And so once you can kind of understand them and what they're going through, it makes the job of writing them, you know, that not, it's never easy, unfortunately, but it feels at least surmountable.
And you understand them. You feel like you're understanding these people as you're going through. And you really feel like you understood Pamela and what was going on inside her head. And I could say, like, you know, for somebody who was just thinking about it at that time, you know, it's like the fear of what people have of, oh, wow, where could this happen? Yeah. And then we've got Denise's mother, she's one of the victims. She wanted none of the details really revealed. Don't talk about what happened. It's like death was tough enough, but to hear the rest would just be too much. And I was always thinking about the family with the trial. Were you able to talk to any of the family members and see what they felt?
Okay. No. I mean, there was so little written about them that I didn't even really have names. Mm-hmm. And I think I would have felt, I don't know how many of the family members are still living. And I don't know that I would have felt comfortable reaching out to them. I would have been, you know, just hesitant to do that, I think.
Yeah. And it's like, because it's still great. It's still, that day comes up, that date comes up on the calendar every year and they're still thinking of what happened and they're still doing the same math you're doing. She would have been 60 something. She would have been 50 something.
Right.
You know, and then we've got, you know, the page 84, all of a sudden we meet Ruth. And while we've been through the trauma of the other women, this is something new. And what happened to her feels different. And we're trying to figure out as readers, what was Ruth? What was going on? What drew you to have her come in like at that point? Because she's the one victim. We really don't know what happened. Like we're kind of, where is she? What happened to her? And
right.
You know, she's living
4 years prior to what happened to Pamela at the sorority house. So Ruth's story, so it was kind of hard to like fit everything together. I never, you know, at one point there were like three point of views. But Ruth's story, interestingly enough, was the one part of all of this that never gave me any trouble. And I just kind of wrote her story on its own. I didn't try and split it up and like weave it with Pamela's or anyone else's. I just wrote her story. All I knew about her was the day that she was abducted and the circumstances under which she was abducted. Because again, there was very little written about the victims and there were really two victims that day at Lake Sammamish, outside of Seattle. And, all I knew that I knew about her and what I wanted to come across, is that, is this thing that I kind of realized while I was working on this and researching these crimes, which was, I think I thought that a lot of the victims went off with this killer, not went off, but like how he was able to kind of target as many women as he did was because of the lore that was out there about him, that he was handsome and charismatic and smart and women trusted him or, you know, felt, you know, that they could, you know, take him at his word because he looked like a normal person. But what I discovered in doing the research, was that any time that there was an eyewitness account of one of the victims going off with him or being approached by him, he had always feigned injury. He was always either on crutches or he had a fake cast on his arm, which in the case of the Lake Sammamish victims, he was wearing a fake cast and said he needed help loading his boat into the car. And so what I wanted to get at with Ruth's character and her story was showing that women didn't go off with him because they were foolish or they didn't have a sense about him that he was, could be dangerous. It was because he asked them for help and they didn't know how to say no. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I thought, who would Ruth be? What would her family history be? What would her story be? And I really wanted it to be that she came from a moment early in her day where she finally stood up for herself. She'd said no to someone who was very difficult to say no to, who was her mother. Mm-hmm. And her kind of threshold for letting people down or not taking care of people had been already exceeded that day. And so here this guy comes along and asks for her help. And she's like, I can't possibly say no to somebody again, because I've already disappointed enough people today. And so from there, I started thinking about who she was and what her story was.
Yeah. And you're thinking about the people who said no to him on the beach that day. And you wonder later on, like how they felt. Like, wait a second, that was the guy. And you could just picture people calling the next day going, I saw that. I remember walking past there. What did I see and what did I miss? You know? And then we have Tina, who's convinced that this is the same killer, the killer in Florida, who killed her friend. And she finds camaraderie in Pamela. She's like, oh, this is really good. But Tina always feels a little bit off to me. Like, there's like, what's going on with Tina? And I think it's because she was a victim of abuse, and she was playing, she was coming at this from so many different points of view, because she herself was so conflicted inside about what was going on, that when she was approaching the story, was she approaching it the right way or dealing with Pamela the right way? That's what I was taking away from.
I just thought of her as being someone who had the tools of kind of a therapist and had studied psychiatry and kind of understood human nature and kind of understand the dynamics between, you know, of the world and of being a woman in the world. And she just didn't have any self-restraint when it came to like bossing people around and telling them this is how it's going to be and this is how you have to live your life. And a little bit, I feel like when I started to finally develop those tools for myself, later in life than I probably should, but like, you know, as a woman in the world, I was like people pleaser and didn't know how to say no and didn't know how to create boundaries. Once you start figuring it out, it's like you just want to scream it from the rooftops, like, oh my God, like you can say no to people, you can do what's best for you and what feels good to you, you know. And sometimes people just aren't ready to hear that or receive that, you know? And so I like the idea of Tina being like, I see the light and I need you to see the light too. And just being really bullish about it.
You need to be with me on this. You need to be with me. You know, it was just, you know, I like the structure going back and forth between the characters, the time and place, but it all feels seamless. And I didn't have to go back and forth and figure out what the action was, like figure out who was doing what. Did you work a lot on that? Because I feel like it was so smooth. It's like, wait a second.
I mean, thank you for saying that. It was not a smooth or seamless process to get it to read smooth and seamless. I will just say that there were many, many drafts involved in this.
No, it's, you know, and I was sitting there, I was realizing that usually I fold down pages in a book when I want to do an interview. I have very few pages folded down because I was so remembering the story I wasn't folding down. I was like, and every once in a while, I go, what did I have about that one? Was I just folding it down because I went to sleep there? I'm like, what was that one for? That was for. And, you know, I really did love too that the perpetrator is never named. And it's interesting because there's some people who didn't know who it was. And it's like, according to your age, you may know, remember this or not, but people can quickly figure it out. And I felt like this gave him no agency. And I felt like that could have been what you're looking for. And you call the killer the defendant. And I love that instead of glorifying what his role was, you just the defendant. And did you know that right from the start? That's the way I'm going.
So right from the start, I knew that I wouldn't name him because I felt like he's been named enough over the years. And I did want to deny him, you know, identity and personhood and all of these things that the women had been denied for a long time. But I think I was just in initial drafts, I was just calling him the man or that man. But over time, as I was reading the transcripts, one thing kept popping out to me, which is that in the transcripts, he was referred to as the defendant. And this was interesting to me because part of his whole shtick was how badly he wanted people to see him as this promising young law student, and that he was an attorney who represented himself in his own murder trial. Well, the truth of that is it's a little fuzzier than that. It's not as clean as the media made it seem, which is, yes, he was a law student at one point in many years of kind of bouncing around from concentration to concentration. There was psychiatry for a minute. He thought he wanted to be a psychiatrist, and then he thought he wanted to be a politician, and he was doing stuff with the Republican Party. And then he settled on law. And all of this was not about necessarily a passion. It was all about what is a profession that will make people see me a certain way, which is educated and well-read and rich, you know? And so there wasn't, he didn't really apply himself in any way. I found out he was a notoriously poor student. He had pretty average IQ. He had to falsify his transcripts to even be accepted to law school. And he was only there about 6 or 7 months before he was arrested for the attempted murder and kidnapping of a Utah woman. And so by the time he was serving, by the time his trial happened in Miami, he had been and he was ultimately convicted of that, of the kidnapping and attempted murder of the Utah woman. So by the time he was on trial for the murders in Florida, he had been a convicted felon for many more years than the couple of months he spent in law school. And yet he was written about as though he had been in his third year of law school and passed the bar, and any day now he was going to be an attorney. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And he had a whole team of attorneys. And in the transcripts, the attorneys were always referred to by their last names, Mr. or Miss, whatever. But he was always the defendant. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that was the most accurate representation of his kind of long con that he was playing on everyone. Like, oh yeah, I'm a law student. No, actually, you're the defendant. And once again, you are on trial for murder. So that's where that came from.
And even if you say you're defending yourself, that doesn't mean that you're a bright young man. That doesn't mean any of these things.
Or an attorney. Anyone can defend themselves. You do not have to be a licensed attorney in order to defend yourself at your own trial.
Right.
Which is something I didn't know.
I didn't know. And it's like, yeah. And I was doing war reading, which we'll get into a second, because I went down a rabbit hole the other night too. And it's the war about the defendant was exaggerated. Yes. He was charismatic, a lawyer, a bright young man. And so much we knew was wrong. It's like the media got it wrong. Everybody, it's like once the narrative got out there, the narrative stayed the same. Yeah. And he was going to the electric chair, like with that narrative still going through. And I found that was really crazy is the night before he was executed, days before, they were begging him to say who else he had killed. And he was feeding them out as like little tidbits, like, oh, so-and-so. Oh, and they were showing pictures and trying to get closure. And right to the end, he was that arrogant young man instead of that bright young man. I don't know. He also took advantage of women and he played them. And, you know, at this point, he was all over the country. I mean, like what you said, he was up in Seattle, he's in Utah, he's in Colorado. And I wonder if today he would have been caught any more easily. Or is it like, would they have put all this together? Like they would have figured out what's going on?
I mean, I think in reading about the Gilgo Beach killer in Long Island, where they finally caught him, some of what I was reading about that is, you know, in, and also in, even before that, in my research, that like, serial killers have always existed. But their mechanisms change over the centuries. So like when we read, you know, even just, kind of the mythology around like werewolves and vampires, a lot of times they say that, you know, that was actually what like villagers came up with, like that was their version of a serial killer. So if there were like a lot of bodies turning up, people thought, oh, it's this mythical creature, it's a werewolf or a vampire. Actually, it was just what we now recognize as a serial killer. They've always existed. Mm-hmm. For a period of time, so the 70s and 80s, people think of it as kind of like the most well-known kind of era around serial killers, because you have like the Night Stalker, you have the Golden State Killer. They all have these kind of catchy names that we remember. And a lot of them, I think, were seemingly normal and targeted everyday people. And then they kind of went away. Well, that's not really true. What happened was, people came to understand that like, just because someone is normal seeming does not mean that they couldn't be capable of this very abnormal behavior. So serial killers started targeting more vulnerable people, sex workers, people who had lost, you know, runaways, people who had lost track of their families, who didn't have people who were saying like, you know, oh, my daughter or my son didn't come home tonight. You know, they already were living on the streets and were vulnerable in all these other ways. Nowadays, what they say is happening, because I remember reading about the Gilgo Beach killer, like it would be it's very difficult to kind of operate at the level that, you know, these guys were operating and not get caught in this day and age, because there's so much surveillance, you know, everything is kind of digitized. Our locations are being tracked constantly, whether we're aware of it or not. they say now that with a lot of like the mass killings and the shootings that we're seeing, that these are people that maybe 30 years ago would have operated under the more traditional definition of a serial killer. But this is now, you know, this is now how they choose to kind of wreak this havoc because we have access to guns and mm-hmm. you can take advantage of people in that way. So it's like, that was part of my research that I realized where it's like this constantly kind of shape-shifting manifestation of this very sinister behavior.
Yeah, it's and you know, it's funny because I remember the Golden State Killers, the Hillside Strangler, they all had names. And I remember one day I was watching TV and they said the BTK killer has been found. They broke into television and said this.
Yeah.
And I was looking, I was like, I have no idea what they're talking about. Like no idea who the person was. And I was thinking of the victims' families and thinking about this. Yet there's an author, and I can't remember who it is right now, that said, I lived in fear. It might've been Alafair Burke, who said, I lived in fear of this guy all the time because I like knew that area, or I knew it. I was like, wow, yeah. I never thought about that. I never knew who that person was. And then here we've got.
He was very localized to a certain area. So maybe it would have been more if you were living in that part of the country. It must have been very terrifying. That's
like breaking into homes and stuff like that, you know. Yeah. And I did go down the rabbit hole and read up on Ted Bundy. I mean, I did go on Wikipedia the other night. And, you know, there was more than him. I was looking at the pictures of the victims because they had these black and white photos there. And I realized that when I was looking at them, I thought I knew a lot. But after reading your book, I was looking at the whole thing with different eyes. And you're just looking at, like, who are these women? And you realize, like, how young these women were when you were sitting looking at their pictures. And the narrative of where he went and what he did became bigger to me. And I've done a lot of reading on, you know, these kinds of subjects. But it was really all those little nuances of what happened that were going on.
I mean, I find it interesting that, and this is just my, this is just like my own instinct, but I do find it interesting that he was so obsessed with, you know, the appearance of intelligence and accomplishment, mm-hmm. and that he tended to target women on college campuses, all of whom actually possessed those qualities. And I do say this in the book where it's, I think that these, you know, he targeted those kinds of women because they had the qualities that he wished he had, that he mm-hmm. wanted so desperately to have.
They were the bright young women. They were the bright young women that he wished he would attract. He wished that he would be, that they would like, they would want to be with him all the time and things like that. But instead, that's how he get, you know, got to do that.
Or that he could be as accomplished as they actually were, and that, and as they would have been if they had been allowed to live.
Yeah. Also in the research, I read that Polly Nelson, who was a member of his last defense team, felt that the defendant was the definition of heartless evil. So picture you have to defend this person and you're feeling like this. And she even wrote a book about him called Defending the Devil. Did you read that? And did you read the Ann Rule book, The Stranger Beside Me? Did you read those?
I read Ann Rule. Oh my gosh. Look, it's sitting right next to me still. It's just so like filled. And then I read The Only Living Witness by Stephen King.
Right.
I relied on these two a lot. But no, I didn't read Defending the Devil.
Yeah. It was, I remember Ann Rule describing that book. There was a dinner years ago, a thriller author's dinner, and I couldn't go. And I was out of town. So I said to my son, who works with me, you know, you go in my place. So he's at this dinner and it's Ann Rule. And Lisa Gardner was somebody who absolutely like loved. And he says, okay, you two sit next to each other and they're sharing dessert and they're talking about these stories. And Greg goes, that was one of my coolest moments. He says, I have to say, because I knew enough about Ann Rule from you from through the years. And he says, to sit there, why don't you just share dessert together? You know, I just love that. You know, so did you outline this whole book in advance? Did you figure out what you were doing? No. Oh God, no.
No, I'm not an outliner. I just find it to be a wasted exercise because it's so hard. It feels so wooden to me to outline the action and the story. And then when I actually sit down to try and write it, it doesn't feel real to me. Mm-hmm. I tend to find the story through multiple drafts, which is very hard because mm-hmm. I'll write my way all the way through and then I see, you know, or I'll reach a certain point and realize, oh, this is actually where the story needs to be headed. So I need to go back and like rejigger everything. I'm going through it on a draft of something now. And it's tough. It's tough throwing out. It's tough to feel like you're on the right track and to do a lot of really good work and a lot of, you know, really good writing and to reach a point and be like, oh, actually, this is what needs to happen and to have to kind of go back and start all over from square one. But unfortunately, I don't know another way.
I know, and a lot of authors talk about it. I mean, Kristen Hanna said that with The Four Winds, she was 35,000 words in and realized who the protagonist was. And it wasn't who she had originally thought. And all of a sudden, the story is going to make more sense if you do this. So tossing everything is hard. You have to get like, you know, a bucket and throw it in. But it's going to make better sense and it's going to work better if you do this, even though it's, you know, due over time. And I do find even the times where like when the computers first came up and, you know, doing something would disappear and then you'd have to recreate it. And recreating was a lot.
I just made my stomach like drop thinking about that.
But recreating was easier because you knew like, oh, I'm going to leave that out. That doesn't really work. Okay. That'll be there. You know? So it's like, so when it comes down to who sees your work first, when you finish it, when you're done, agent, editor, who?
My lit agent and my editor. Yeah. They both get it. And then, I wait for them to come back and tell me everything that isn't working.
Get some advice on where we're going, you know, exactly. That's exactly. How long did this book take to write? How long did it was
a long time. I've been working on it like 3 to 4 years and not continuously. I've had to set it aside for periods of time while I worked on other things. But it's been a part of my life up until I would say as recently as February of this year, because I was still getting, you know, copy edits and I was still, kind of reworking some of the writing and so it feels like I've and then I went right into kind of late summer thinking about publicity and marketing and what I was going to say about it and write about it and like doing interviews. So it's been with me a long time now.
It's like, I really know this book. I really got this down pat, you know, but it's great because I can tell you love that writing this book. Like you love talking about this book. You believe in the book. And sometimes people finish something and they don't. And it's a big deal when you finish it. That's an even bigger accomplishment to not just finish a book, but to have believed in what you did and still feel good talking about it. I've heard you do a number of interviews and you're passionate about it every single time. And you talk about different things every time too, which I love.
Yeah. The characters feel very real to me and fully realized. And like, I understand them very intimately, which to me is like a marker of success, that I got that deep with them.
Yeah. So did it get any easier from the last two books or is it just the same thing?
No, it's just different. Everyone is different. The easiest one I ever did was Luckiest Girl Alive. And I think it's because I had no sense of how any of it was going to work. Mm-hmm. I just knew I had to write it. And, you know, then, you know, fortunately for me, I had a literary agent kind of before I wrote it because I was writing for women's magazines. I was at Cosmo and, you know, and before that I had briefly worked at a agency myself and met my future agent there. We were both assistants just out of college and we kind of kept in touch over the years. And she was the one to reach out to me and say, you're doing such great writing at Cosmo. You should write a book. We'll take it out and sell it together, but the whole thing has to be written. So I think, you know, definitely there were like a couple of years where there would be like aborted attempts. Like I would write a couple pages of something and be like, I'm not really sure where this is going. And I thought about who the character would be and what the story was I wanted to tell. But after a while of doing that, just like one day I sat down and it clicked and I just kind of wrote it in like a fugue state. And I do think it was easier to write because I had no sense of what it would look like when it came out. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get kind of hung up on some of the worries and anxieties that I have now. I feel like I know too much now.
You know too much on the back end. It's like,
yeah, I know how the sausage gets made.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, the sausage is made on the back end. You know, you also sell very well overseas. If I think I saw there were like 37 countries for Luckiest Girl Alive, like some really big number. Is it because you think you write about a universal topic? Like it's things that people understand?
I don't know, because I mean, that was true for Luckiest Girl Alive. I don't know that my overseas deals are that like robust with my other two books. And I do wonder with this one, if it's if like serial killers feel like a uniquely American thing, which in some ways I think they are. But I don't know. I mean, I wonder, I think at the time Luckiest Girl Alive came out, it was very much, we were still in the era of like Gone Girl and everyone wanting the next title that had girl in the title that, you know, was juicy and had twists and turns and all of that. So I wonder if there was just like a little bit of a feeding frenzy around that period in time in particular.
Yeah. Look, you know what was happening. Okay. Yeah. And Right Young Women, was that always the title? Was that always the title?
It really was. It was always the title because it was pulled from the judge's remarks where he called him a bright young man. And I was like, he's not at all. And actually the women were, but there was a moment where, you know, we were like, cause I was working on this for so long that Promising Young Women was out in the world and, you know, part of the vocabulary that we had and people were feeling like it was too similar, but then it just took so long for me to get a polished version of this to go into production that it felt like, two titles could live, you know, without kind of competing with each other.
In the same area. They could live, both be books. It's okay.
Yeah.
How about this cover? The cover is like great. The way her eyes, are, I just love it.
Yeah. That was their first attempt. The first one that they showed me. Yeah. They really knocked it out of the park.
No, it's great because you see the haunt. You want to see the haunt inside of what's going on. Yeah.
And they said they were inspired by horror posters from the 1970s for it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense, especially with the timing of what happened.
Yeah.
So for the audio, you have four performers doing an ensemble reading. Was that your idea or what can you tell us about it?
No, I mean, we knew we needed three. We needed Tina, Ruth, and Pamela. And then, you know, there was a conversation about like, do we have someone come in to do the killer's voice? And ultimately we decided yes. But that like the cover is kind of the audio and the cover are kind of two parts of my job that I really like because it's the one time where I get to just sit back and be like, what are your suggestions? Show me what you've got, you know, everything else from the writing to the editing, to the marketing, to the publicity, I have to be such a part of, which was also a surprise, you know, some talk about now knowing how the sausage gets made. When I initially wrote Luckiest Girl Alive, I thought my only job was as a writer. And I was like, oh, now marketing and publicity will take care of the rest of it. And I get to just like sit back and enjoy the whole process. Yeah, no.
And your job's gotten even bigger since you wrote that book. That becomes even bigger, the role of what's going on.
It's crazy. Someone was just asking me about this the other day. It feels like for almost any industry, you have to almost be, it's like you're a small business owner. And I thought that was like one of the best metaphors that I'd ever heard. I'm like, it's so true. You have to wear so many different hats.
Yeah. And every once in a while, like I'll say, wait, did we post this on social media or not? Like, have we done this? And I said, next week, because we had a lot going on, I said, we need to do a regroup and figure out what hasn't been up. And you know what? It doesn't matter that we did it 3 weeks ago. It doesn't matter because it still hasn't been there. So it's like still okay. And I think you have to forgive yourself after a while too, because it all feels super daunting at this point that you have to get it all done. And it's like, okay, we did 5 of the 10 things today. Like, we'll just take the 5. We did 9 of the 10, you know?
Yeah.
This is like, what's going on? So did you have any, so you were a screenwriter. Picking the talent, like, did you hear the voices, though, of what's going to happen for the audiobook? Did you know what you wanted, like, when you heard?
Yeah, I mean, well, like, Sutton Foster is, like, obviously such a coup. So it's like, the fact that, like, she was interested in doing this was, like, it wasn't, like, I needed her, like, I had to listen to it and be, like, okay, I'm down. Like, it was just, like, they said the name Sutton Foster, and I was, like, wait, she wants to do it? That's amazing. But, yes, with some of the other roles, yes, you would listen to some audition tapes and weigh in about it. Yeah.
Which is good. We think is going to be perfect for this. I know you're going to be adapting Bright Young Women for TV, and it will also serve as executive producer with the team that you work with on Luckiest Girl Alive, which was just such great news. When I saw that the other day, I was like, this is like really, is that what you're working on next? Is that the next thing, or are there things between the next thing?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that should be the next thing. So it's definitely kind of like part of that group. I am getting ready to, I'm more of a kind of an outliner when it comes to the screenwriting side of things, just because it's like a less kind of bulky undertaking. So I have to pitch kind of my idea for the pilot episode and kind of loosely where I see how I see the season going. And obviously what makes the adaptation unique and all of these things. I'm going to pitch that to the producers, and then I'll sit down and actually write the pilot episode. And I'm sure there'll be some, because the producers kind of act as your editor. Mm-hmm. They'll have notes and kind of that'll go back and bounce around a few times between me and them. And then likely what will happen is they will set the meetings with the streamers, and I'll go in and they'll read the pilot episode, and then I'll also pitch my vision for the season. And then hopefully someone wants it and makes an offer.
You know, so much has happened with this. You know, so much has happened with streaming. I actually watched Luckiest Girl Alive the other night. I rewatched it. Yeah. And it was just so great to see, like, you know, what happened. But you think of that as like, there's the movie. Now all of a sudden it's a 7-part or 10-part, you know, miniseries. Yeah. It's this, and how to keep the action going, and how am I going to tell this? What's going to happen at where we fade to black? Like, what are we going to do? And the one thing I've really loved is that you always see the writer's name. Well, first of all, the based on the book by, but even if you fast forward, I was telling people this a couple of weeks ago, I was doing an event with Megan Abbott. It always says written by and directed by. You can't fast forward through those two when you say skip intro. And I said, it's like,
the people I never knew that.
Watch it, because it's really interesting, because sometimes a series will have so many different directors. It could have 7.
Yeah.
So this episode producers is, this is by blah, blah, blah. And you see at the beginning who the executive producers are. When you're author friends, you like, oh, yay, this is like really fun. Yeah. I see their name. But you see, like, we're written by, and I realize it's because sometimes it's, and I remember Laura Dave saying this for the last thing you told me. She is, no, we might write 2. And then the last one, some we may write, but then in between, they're going to be different directors. And that's, I think, the fascinating thing that people don't understand, like, about, it's not all seamless. It doesn't all just go like this. It's who you can get for different things too.
With a show, it's a little different. I mean, with a film, there's only one director, but with a show, typically what happens is the director, the person who directs the pilot episode is almost, I don't want to say is seen as like the director for the whole thing, but they really set the tone for it. So they might do like the first 1 to 3 episodes, and then other, you know, other directors would direct future episodes. And kind of same with the writing, with shows, like you have a writer's room, and you know, different writers might get credit for different episodes. I haven't show run, you know, Laura co-show run her show with her husband. So she knows a lot more about the making of a show than I do. So I'm only saying what I know from, you know, friends who have been part of their books being adapted into shows. And obviously it's like a very different, and it's also a much longer shoot time, that which makes sense, than a film, where a film were, you know, in production for like 3 months. A show can be like almost your entire year. So it's a huge undertaking that Laura did. And obviously she did a phenomenal job.
Good job. You know, it was funny, because when Megan was talking about it, they said, what does the showrunner mean? She goes, you don't get a lot of sleep. She said, that's what it really means, is because you're the person that has to make every decision of what's going on. Very, very interesting. Yeah. When you're writing a book, do you make any notes about, if I'm going to adapt it, I might do this or that, or it's really staying in the zone of the book?
Yeah, staying in the zone of the book, because what works for a book isn't necessarily what will work on screen in some cases with certain things. And like, that's okay. That's the nature of an adaptation, is that you're flexible with certain elements that maybe aren't going to translate on screen, and you have to, you know, be willing to kind of let those things go and hold on to the things that really do matter. So I try not to get too hung up in things in a novel where I'm like, wait, actually, I don't think that would work really well on screen, because that's fine. And you have to do the, you have to do the thing that services the material of the book.
Where you are right now. So besides everything else, you're working on a new novel?
I'm working on a new novel. I'm working on another screenplay right now that's an adaptation of a viral Reddit thread, which is interesting for Sony. And then the kind of getting the pitch ready for the adaptation of this. So yeah, a few things kind of percolating.
At least if you have free time, you could sit there and go, oh, I think I'll just pluck that one out of the air and do that one now. Oh,
yeah.
Here, I could always... Let me just visualize how I would think this would be. Yeah, it's never boring. Let's put it this way. Yeah. I feel like right now, being you is not boring at all. You
know? It's not. No, I'm grateful for it. Yeah.
I'm so glad we got to do this. I really enjoyed the book too. And I love being able to have a conversation with you about it, because you hit on so many of the notes about these women that I really want to make sure we're percolating with the readers as well.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for your time. Yeah. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
To our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To, where remember, we're a book reporter at the Book Report Network on YouTube, and Book Reporter Talks To wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for joining us. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Bright Young Women by Jessica Knoll, narrated by Sutton Foster, Amani J. Powers, Corey Brill, and Chris Henry Coffey, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Bright Young Women, narrated by Sutton Foster, Amani Jade Powers, Corey Brill, and Chris Henry, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Hi, I'm Sutton Foster. I am in the studio recording the audiobook for Bright Young Women. I'm so excited for everyone to hear it. It's an awesome book.
It must have been more than hunger pains that roused me. But at the time, all I wanted was to go downstairs and make myself a peanut butter sandwich and fall right back to sleep. I rolled out of bed, stretching, groaning, when I saw myself in the small oval mirror tacky glued to the wall. I'd fallen asleep fully clothed, using my textbook for a pillow. After I'd posted the volunteer schedule to the bulletin board outside the bathrooms, I'd moved on to the reading for Monday morning's American Political Thought, and now my cheek bore a faint printing of the Equal Rights Amendment. I rubbed at it hard with the heel of my hand,